another edition of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Rocky, and we got a bright, sunny, finally warm day here in East Central Illinois. And we're going to continue on, as we've been doing, with some discussions with some incredible authors that are writing books, providing information to everybody, and giving us an opportunity to relax and enjoy and do something different. How do we put that all together? I mean, it's extremely important. We have to have many facets in our life, and one thing I found extremely important to me is both reading and writing. And we got two incredible authors joining us tonight. We've got Maureen Hughes, who's written two incredible books, and these are books are, she's an investigative journalist. I mean, that's the only way to put it, isn't Maureen?
That's correct, Doug.
And the other we have, Joanne, are you there also?
I'm here, yes.
Fantastic. We've got Joanna Beth Tweedy. And Joanna, she's a Texas girl, I think. Well, anyhow, she's written a book about Texas, correct?
Actually, the book is not about Texas, but there's a character in the book who's named Texas.
Ah, okay. So I thought what we'd have tonight is just kind of have a roundtable discussion with two really neat authors on what's involved in writing books, what are their books about, how can other people get to writing books, what kind of research do you need to do in order to write books. So why don't we start out as with Maureen, you've written two absolutely incredible books, A Countess and the Mob and Sins of the South. Now, I've read both of these books multiple times, and you and I became good friends because we're both investigative type of people, wanted to dig in and find out. How did you ever get involved into writing and doing in-depth, real-world forensic and everything else investigations?
Doug, my background is law enforcement. I've got a full bachelor's degree in criminal justice, and I started my master's and haven't finished it. But I feel like I had some of the best instructors, some of the best trainers that a law enforcement officer could ask for. They didn't settle for second best, and I have learned to not settle for second best in my career.
Yeah, you've had a very long career.
yeah, it is. And I'm happy about that because it's been so full of events. Have I had any boring days? Sure, that goes with it. But I can honestly say my career has been one big excitement. I have met movie stars, well-known authors, VIPs in both in the area and the country. And I think I have been very fortunate.
It makes for an exciting life, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
When
I was asked by a former deputy governor to Illinois to investigate the death of his father, that was another education because it not only involved what I know in law enforcement and how to apply it, but it was a part of the state of Illinois that I had misconceptions about.
So, yeah, this is your latest book, Sins of the South, correct?
That's correct, yes.
And both of your books, I mean, Sins of the South and The Countess and the Mob, these are based on real people and all the real events that have happened. Well, I guess probably it's going back, 70 or 80 years totally involved, correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. To the 1920s, even. It's both cases were different, but they had a lot of similarities. And one of the key points that I learned was that the mafia had totally infiltrated the state of Illinois. I believe that it was primarily in Chicago or East St. Louis, and I was wrong. Southern Illinois was totally covered with mafia people, high level and low level.
That's totally astonishing. Joanna, your book is a book on Southern fiction, correct?
On Southern fiction?
I said your book, The Yonder Side Assassin, Texas? This is basically a fiction book, Southern fiction. What is it about, and how did you get involved in writing?
Well, many bookstores have classified it as Southern fiction. I call it literary fiction, but it certainly encompasses many aspects of the South, and one of those is the South Midland dialect. And I think that's one of the things that people find a lot of fun about the book. The dialect is it's spoken in the southernmost part of Illinois, in the Boot Heel area of Missouri, and also the western part of Kentucky, as well as other parts of the United States, but mainly in those areas. And it's just it's a very old dialect. It's lush and it's very imagistic, and so it lends itself to being a very poetic language. And so I think people were surprised by the combination of writing that is from a very rural place, but that is also very poetic. And that's a credit to the people who speak the dialect, because I've been hearing their stories and their language and their beautiful images all of my life. And so I had a ball writing these stories down and capturing this lovely language that is just so rich and such an older form of English. So that's been really fun. But the story is ultimately, about two sisters who grow up in a foothilled fraction of the world, and eventually they venture out into the broad ground beyond and have all kinds of adventures together. But each of the chapters is narrated by a different character, so you get to hear a lot of different voices in the novel. And it was so much fun to write those. It was almost as though the stories, not that they wrote themselves, but I really, these characters were almost speaking to me. Sometimes I would just be overcome and just have to get this story down. And I teach creative writing, and a lot of my students will ask, you know, how do you overcome writer's block? And I always tell them, pay attention to those moments when you are just overwhelmed with the urge to write, when you have to grab a pen or you have to sit in front of that computer and you have to just, you know, write something out or type something out, and find out what's happening in those moments. And for me, it's being around water that inspires me. I don't know why. I can't explain it. But as I started paying attention to those moments, it might be sitting near a lake. I live very close to a lake. It might be something as simple as being in the shower, which isn't very convenient when you have to, you know, run and write something because you're soaking wet, and you're usually getting ready to go somewhere, so you're going to be late wherever you're going.
Yeah, but I did that two times yesterday. Yesterday morning we had the Army and Navy and Air Force and Marine ROTC awards at the University of Illinois. So I was one of the presenters as a retired Army officer, and so I had to take a bath early in the morning again, and get dressed up in a suit to go in and do that. And then at the end of the day, we had another big shindig here in Rantoul, Illinois, a fundraiser for his local Catholic school. And again, you got to get dressed up and put your suit on and go over. So it's kind of like, you know, yeah, and you're in the water, and you're going through, boy, I got all this stuff in my brain. All this stuff is coming out.
Right.
Maureen, what triggered you to get doing the writing?
I, much like your other guest, writing has come easy. I think what really spawned it was I had to write an essay in school at age 13, and it was to be entered into a contest. Well, I'm not going to say I blew it off. I took it very seriously, but I had my doubts of winning. Well, I did. And I think that, and then people saying, like teachers and other people saying, you have a talent. You need to take it as far as it'll go. And the writing, just like she said, I carry a notebook with me, a legal pad, and I will write
thoughts
down.
That's the cop in you, right?
I ought to be sick and tired of writing reports, but No, I do. I'll write words or something that I saw, and maybe a feeling, and then keep all of that. I've got stacks of them. And then when I sit down and write, I often refer back to them if I'm looking for a particular expression or a phrase that I know I'd come up with before.
I think it's a natural thing.
I do. And I think a lot of people have it. They just don't expound upon it.
In your book, The Sins of the South, that has taken place down in far southern Illinois. And Joanna, where you were talking about the girls, that's also in far southern Illinois, Kentucky and Missouri area, correct?
It is. I call it the area that is leapfrogged between the Ozarks and Appalachia. It's a lovely part of the state.
Yeah, very lonely, but I mean, as Maureen found out, very, very interesting in all the history and everything that happened and the reaches and the extent of it. For both of you, what was research like? I mean, you're talking a story about some girls and some sisters growing up and moving out of this area down there. And so, again, you're working with a fiction. But what kind of research did you have to do to get the feeling and understanding for, you know, what you're writing about and portray the characters in a story?
Most of the research that I did had to do with linguistics. And I really, part of the reason I wanted to write this novel is because of what I have discovered about the dialect, the South Midland dialect. I never knew I spoke a dialect, by the way, until I left the region. I went to college. My undergraduate degree was completed at the University of Illinois in Urbana.
Yeah, right here.
Yes, your local stomping grounds. And so, people I met, I would use words and phrases that were funny to them, words they'd never heard before in their lives, and I grew up hearing these words and phrases all my life, so it wasn't funny to me at all. And so I started looking into this, and, you know, people think that I spoke with an accent, and of course I thought everyone there spoke with an accent. Most people were from the northern part of the state.
Yeah, I think the interesting part is most of the students at the University of Illinois are from the Chicago regional area.
Yes, yes. And I did discover that, you know, over the course of those years at the U of I, I did flatten out my accent quite a bit and lost a goodly portion of it, but I still, my husband tells me there are four times when I speak in my dialect, and that's either when I'm talking about down home, when I'm speaking with someone from down home, or when I'm praying, because of course that's the language I grew up with, and also when I drink whiskey. So those are the times that it comes back. But the fascinating thing that I discovered was that I had much more than an accent. It was an actual dialect, and the difference between those things are, it's important. An accent is just it's really just a sonic effect, so the articulation that you use when you speak. But a dialect is a regional variety of language that has distinguishing characteristics like vocabulary, very different vocabulary, and also different grammatical structures to it. And then also the differences in pronunciation. And so the more that I discovered, the more I started studying American dialects, the more fascinated I became with just how we speak so differently in this country in very small ways that we may not even realize. And I'd always thought, you know, it's very fascinating. I've done a lot of travel, and of course in England, there are just an immense variety of dialects there. But not a lot of people think about the United States having a variety of dialects. They think of maybe a southern accent or something like that, when in fact the South has about five or six different distinct dialects to it. And once you just start studying those, it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know when I was a visiting scholar at Cambridge in England, they said, well, you're speaking English, but you're not speaking English. You're speaking a distinct American dialect.
Yes, yes.
It was very strange.
I used to work at a pub in Ireland, on the west coast of Ireland, and they used to tease me about my accent and call me Daisy Duke because that was their you know, reference, television reference to the Kentucky area. And I've since gone back to visit those fishermen. I used to, it was a pub, like I said, on the very west of Ireland, and there were a group of fishermen who would always come into the pub. And after studying dialects and everything, I would go back and I told them, I said, you know, I did discover that the dialect I speak is actually an older form of English than the language that you speak. And they were stunned by that, but it's true, because in Appalachia, a lot of older forms of English were preserved simply because of the way that when people came from the Old World to the New World and settled in the Appalachian region, they were cut off from the rest of the world based on really just geography, the mountains and everything like that. And so they came with different ways of speaking. There was a vowel shift that was going on in England at the time. So as people were shifting the way that they spoke in England, the people who had come to America and settled in Appalachia still spoke that way. And, of course, their language didn't shift like people on the east coast of the United States. Their language did shift to match what was going on the continent. And so you really find this older form of English in Appalachia than you do in the rest of the United States, and it's really a lovely thing.
Maureen, as you started doing the research for your two books, and the Sins of the South taking place, very real-world, real-time criminal investigation about a homicide, a murder that had happened many, many years ago. How did all this come into play? Because what we're listening, hearing what Joanna's describing, there's a very distinct culture, very distinct language, interaction and everything down in that region. How did you...
There is, and that's what I was speaking about when I said that I got an entirely new education. I was on a book tour with the Countess and the Mob, which was about the newspaper owner in Champaign.
At the News Gazette.
Yes, that's correct. And I was approached by Bob Winchester, who was deputy governor under Governor Ryan.
This is for the state of Illinois.
Yes, to look into the case, which was a cold case, of his father's death. Initially, it was ruled a suicide. The state of Illinois was to reopen it and investigate further. This was never done. So it went on for 56 years as a suicide. And again, I proved through a new investigation that it was murder. And I also showed where two guns had been used. And I also talked with the elderly man in Tennessee who lived in Cairo at the time of this death and was hired by two gangsters to drive them to the spot where they were to kill Winchester.
Fascinating. And both of you, I mean, when you're doing your investigation, one thing, Maureen, you and I have talked about before when we've had these local awful fairs and everything, we've sat together over lunch, what did you find it like as you start to do the investigations and uncover information or gather information or verify information that maybe people don't want to hear or people don't want out, or the individuals involved, even if they're deceased or they're, you know, people that are left over, don't want out? How does that come into play, or what did you learn about that?
That's something I think you have to use your talents to, number one, gain the individual's confidence. I think you have to prove yourself, number one. You have to ensure that what they say may be put in writing, but not with a name attached. And this I did this. I'm not going to say it was easy, and probably Joanna found the same issue. The people in Southern Illinois are very protective. They're very secretive about their past. They actually don't want to be remembered by the bad things, which is normal. I found the people, most of the people, very, very kind and good. It was the few that I really needed to talk to that they were very quiet. They wouldn't talk to me in the state of Illinois. We would have to go to Missouri or Kentucky. And this was also true in the Countess and the Mob.
The Countess and the Mob, you ended up finding out interactions with senior people throughout the United States and throughout the whole Western Hemisphere, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I even talked to two professional guns. The one that was retired could see me, but I couldn't see him. I had to go over to Indiana to a specific payphone and call a specific number, and he talked to me and confirmed a lot of the material that I had heard about Mrs. Kinigo. The second hitman or professional gun is still active, and I have no idea what his name is, but we met in a public place in Urbana, and likewise, he confirmed much of the information on Roselli that I had received.
Well, you connected everything. You've got the U.S. government involved, you got the Italian government involved, you got the CIA, the forerunner of the CIA involved. You got all of these. You got the Kennedys involved. You got the stuff involved in Cuba. I mean, it's just an extraordinary, extraordinary thing where you think, how could these connections from a small community here in East Central Illinois reach out all across the nation and the world to some of the highest echelons?
You're right, and I did not expect that, but the deeper I dug, the worse it got. I was appalled, really, that many people, well, first of all, that Mrs. Kinigo knew that many people. And when I would confirm much of the things that I had learned, like I talked to Joseph Wambaugh, I talked to Harrison Ford, many, many people that thought the world of Marijan, but also saw two sides, as I did.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And it was interesting because I took a lot of flack from the Countess and the Mob. Many people would not talk to me. This is what shocked me. Some of them would not talk to me out of fear. They either still worked at the newspaper or they had recently retired. And if they did talk to me, they did not want their names used.
Joanna, as you started telling the story and looking in the background to tell the stories, yours is a fiction work. Mm-hmm. How did you interplay or do the research on the culture and society to tell that story to make it exciting? How does one go about doing that?
Well, I grew up in southernmost Illinois, so I'm very familiar with the region, with the people, with the way that nature is so much a part of the way people live here. And so I think that with all of those things combined, it wasn't necessarily difficult to do that sort of research, just writing from my own background, which it sounds like Maureen has done a lot of too, writing from the background of an investigative reporter, with her training and everything like that. And I think that many writers do reach into what they know when they put words to the page. And not all writers. Some writers will write entirely outside of what they know, and I appreciate that very much, especially when it's accomplished well, because that does take an incredible amount of research to know your topic so well that you can write about it from a very intimate perspective, because I think some of the best stories, we get very tied up with the narrator in an emotional way. And so I appreciate it very much when an author can write outside of their own background. But I do think that many authors choose to write from what they know. And in fact, that's a lot of the advice that you will receive from other teachers of writing, is to start by writing from what you know. And that's comes very naturally for some people, as it does for me, but it does not come naturally for other people, as I've experienced in my classroom with some of my students. They don't want to write from what they know. They want to reach outside of that and write what they don't know. And Maureen has spoken to, you know, how much research that takes. Not that she didn't know about her topic. Obviously, she was writing from what she knew in terms of how to go about doing investigation, but from what she discovered. And I actually find it fascinating. I know, Maureen, you had mentioned that it was very difficult to get information from people in the southern parts of the state. And I would agree with you that people here are they're very protective of their own people, of their tribe, so to speak. And it can be a tribal culture in many ways. And so they don't, they may be more reticent to speak to an outsider than they would to speak with someone that they know. But it sounds like you gained an incredible amount of information. And so you really must have known well your topic in order to glean that information from people, given the reticent nature of many people to speak or necessarily, you know, let loose with a lot of information to an outsider.
I did. You're right. But on the other hand, it took 8 months to get the information I needed. And I found that records had been altered. Some of them had even been destroyed. And I went into detail about that in the book. Sheriffs would not talk to me. They wouldn't let me into rooms where the records were kept. It was a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're right. They're protective. I think that's a very good word. And granted, I was writing about the bad side. Nonetheless, Southern Illinois is just beautiful. It's a Huckleberry Finn environment. And it just floored me that so much crime was going on then and, quite frankly, still going on.
I think that's one of the things that's astonishing, because when you write a book or you do the research, and I mean, Maureen, you and I have sat down with some other incredible people that also do investigative research and writing and work with the courts a lot. But when you dig in to find that information and then decide, okay, how do I apply this? How do I use the information that I have? Because it's sort of like, okay, am I stepping over that boundary where all of a sudden I'm going to find out that, whoops?
That's right. That's exactly right. And doing this book was probably one of the hardest things I've done. It was not well received. I was approached by two men who told me to get out of Cairo and stay out. And needless to say, I didn't. There were times when it was getting a little hairy, to put it mildly.
When you go to write a book, and this for both of you, how long does it take? I mean, you have to sit down and put out, what do I want to talk about? What am I going to write about? How am I going to put things in order? What is the sequence of events that you guys do as authors to write such successful books?
Well, mine was a story from basically birth through the death of Mr. Winchester. And I think putting it together was not that hard in this book, you know, Sins of the South. It was collecting the information in the appropriate order. People that I would talk to would remember maybe one decade, and somebody else would remember another decade, but yet they were tied in. And that was time consuming. I don't know how Joanna did hers.
Well, I think that some writers are very methodical about the practice of piecing together a book-length publication, and I would imagine that in writing nonfiction, I don't write nonfiction, aside from I'm writing a dissertation right now, so I suppose that counts. But some people are very methodical and have an outline, or you know, and have each chapter planned out as they go. For me, it doesn't work that way. I spend most of my time in revision. The creative process for me flows very naturally, and it's when I have all of that body of work in front of me, and then I'm thinking to myself, okay, how do I want a reader to encounter this? You know, where should they come in on the story? And it's not necessarily in chronological order. In fact, I worked with my publisher to rearrange many of the chapters in the book so that a reader would encounter the story as it unfolds, like they're hearing it from, because they are hearing it from different people. So they're getting different sides and different perspectives and different voices telling them this story. So they're gleaning bits and pieces from different people. So we chose not to go with a chronological telling of the story, but more of an unfolding of the plot and the characters. So that's how The Yonder Side came together, and I've find that with my other writing as well, that it's really after the creative process is finished and going through that revision process and cutting. I cut so much of my work. I cut everything that is not absolutely necessary, and that can be very difficult. I've heard it said, someone said, kill your darlings. I can't remember who said that, but it's very good advice for a writer. Don't be afraid to kill your darlings, because you might think that they're wonderful, but unless they're absolutely necessary to the telling of the story, get rid of it and get on with it. And keep those things that are necessary to your characters, to your plot, to the beauty of the language, but get rid of those things that are extraneous.
When you're talking to students, and Joanna, I mean, your teacher, and you're teaching creative writing and all this stuff, and Marine, as an investigator, police officer, you're kind of a whole other ball game. But how, or what kind of recommendations, or how do you go about reading a book? You know, what's involved in reading a book? What do you look for? What do you think about? How do you teach an individual to read? Because you can read the words, okay, even mouth the words, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily reading the book and getting out of it what's in there.
That's a great question. It's a wonderful question. And, you know, some writers tend to stay in their genre and read just their genre. Other writers really go outside of their genre and read everything. I'm one of those. I really enjoy all kinds of fiction. I enjoy all kinds of nonfiction. I enjoy poetry. It sounds like I would really enjoy Maureen's books too. So,
thank you.
Her books you can't sit down when you pick them up, let me tell you.
I bet. And I think really it's a matter of knowing what you're drawn to and really kind of questioning why you're drawn to it as well. You know, is it character-driven work that you really captures you, or is it a plot? Is it a combination of the two? Which I think some of the best writing comes from a combination of those two things. Or you know, are you someone who really just enjoys the emotive essence of reading? And for that person, maybe sitting with a book of poetry might be the most enjoyable thing for them. to do. I'm very inspired by other writers. I will often really get inspired to write poetry, actually, after I've read something, and I have a stack of books on my nightstand, and actually I'm staring at another stack of books on a desk right now that I'm in the middle of many books at once. I don't finish, go through one book and finish it and then pick up another. I'm reading many books.
And you and I both.
Yeah. And I enjoy that facet of reading. But for other people, they don't like that at all. They really like to stick to one book at a time. And I think it's just coming to understand your own reading preferences and why you enjoy the reading that you enjoy. And discussing books with other people is a wonderful way to learn more about your reading process and to learn more about the book itself, because we all bring ourselves to the reading. And so we all bring a different perspective and a different way of looking at the plot and the characters and looking at how the author has presented the information on the page. And being in a reading group or a book group can be a really fulfilling experience for a lot of people because of that and because of everything that other readers bring to the page.
Vocabulary. How does one develop the vocabulary, first off, just for reading a book, and then how does a person develop the vocabulary for writing a book? I mean, there are very distinctive things there. How does that happen? What can we give suggestions to the individuals, as the kids, the children, the adults, and anything?
Well, learn new words.
Yeah.
Really. I think earlier I mentioned that I will keep a legal pad with me, and I will write down a word that I've heard, and maybe if I'm not familiar with it but I like it, I will research it and make every attempt to learn that word, how to use it, where to use it. And something I think is important, and the question kind of caught me off guard in a sense. I don't think a person should, or a writer should, write down to people. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I agree with completely.
Okay, good. That's kind of hard to describe, but
if I
use a word that I'm real familiar with and use frequently, I may use it in my book, but then kind of elaborate on that word. So if somebody is reading the book, but that particular word isn't familiar with them, then further down in the sentence I will say something else that will give the meaning to the word.
Well, that's putting the word in context.
Yes, many writers are contextually savvy like that and very aware of their reading audience. For instance, I can read to you maybe a list of 5 words from the South Midland dialect that if I just read these to you in a list, which I'll do right now, we've got collywobble, ballyhoo, pyroot, yammersnitch, hoosegow, and bumfuzzle. You might not have any idea what those words mean.
None whatsoever.
But when I write them in the book, I put them in a context that allows readers to understand what those words mean. They may not land on the exact meaning of the word, but they can get an idea of the contextual function of the word in the sentence based upon how it's been used. And I totally agree with Maureen that you don't write down. I like how you said that you don't write down to your readers. You really assume the best of your reader and don't assume that they don't know what they're reading, because that can make for a very boring reading experience. And that's something that when I was talking about cutting everything that is absolutely extraneous and not necessary, because you've got to trust your reader. You really
That's
do.
Right.
And if you're over-explaining something and hitting someone over the head with something, they're not going to enjoy what you've written at all.
That's right. So, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, so you really have to trust your reader and just keep it moving. You know, if you've done your job contextually well, even if they don't know the exact meaning of the word that you're using, they're going to get contextually what you're saying, and then they may go look up that word later, or they may not. But they've been exposed to a new word, and they've gotten the gist of what it means.
Well,
that's
same
right.
Same thing goes for sentence structure, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and there's just there's so many different ways, and a lot of beginning writers will not vary their sentence structure very much, and that can be a common critique of beginning writers. You know, they will start with the same subject, predicate, subject, predicate, subject, predicate, or there were, there were, there were. And again, that can be very repetitious and not a very exciting experience for a reader who is looking for something very engaging on the page. And so these are things that I suggest to emerging writers to get involved in workshops with other writers if they're not already in school taking classes and in workshops and classes, that they read their writing out loud, too. You can find a lot of mistakes reading your writing out loud, and some of the mistakes that you find are the fact that you're using your sentence structure too repetitively, and it's really getting dull, and you need to vary it and mix it up.
How did you get your editing done? Did you guys, either both of you, I mean, did you have somebody that did editing for you, or the editing process? I know when I've edited my own work, and as you said, you're sitting there going, oh my, I don't want to take that out, but it's got to come out, or I've got to rewrite this. What is the editing process? Do you guys have somebody that does editing for you, or do you edit yourself, or do you have multiple editors, or how does that work?
Well, I think once you get to your work polished enough to where it's ready to go to a publisher, and you've done your research on what publishers you need to submit to, I think that certainly publishers employ editors to help you out. I had some excellent copy editors working on the Yonder Side, wonderful people, and just really a joy to work with. And that can, you know, that another, I think, big thing I would tell other writers is trust your editor as well, because they are in the market for marketing your book. They love your book or they would not have picked it up. Your publisher would not have agreed to publish your book if they didn't think it would sell and if they didn't think that it would be successful. But you really have to trust them. One of the things that my editor told me right out of the gate was, you have to change the title of your book. And I thought I had a wonderful title. And it was Roman Catholics, but Roman was spelled R-O-A-M-I-N. And I thought, oh, you know, that it fit very well because the girls are Catholic, but they roam in their faith as well as roam, you know, in their adventures together. But the way that my publisher explained it, she said, well, you know, you're going to have a group of people who are Catholic who are going to look at this title, and they're going to think that it's a book that makes fun of Catholics, and it's not. And I thought, well, gosh, I never thought of that. I mean, I'm Catholic myself, and then she said, and you're going to have another group of people who are not Catholic who are going to look at this title of this book and think that it's a book about just for Catholics. I never considered that. I just thought, oh, what a clever title. So my next question to her was, I said, okay, great. So what should the title be? And she said, oh, no, 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 no. You've got to figure that out. So she said, you know, brainstorm some titles and just, you know, shoot me a couple of them, and we'll bandy it about, and we'll talk about it, and we did. And I'm so glad that I changed the title. But that was a lesson for me right out of the gate, because The Yonder Side was my debut novel, and so I had not worked directly with a publisher before. And so but I'd always told my students, you know, you need to trust an editor. And so when my editor told me, you need to change the title of your book, the first thing I thought of was, practice what you preach. You know, trust your editor. So I'm glad I did.
Oh, boy, it sounds interesting. you know, there's so much involved in writing, so much in getting, you know, written down very, very well to explain everything. For both of you, what has been the response to your books and your novels? Maureen, I'm very familiar with some of the responses to yours, which have triggered incredible conversations. I mean, but could you both explain that kind of, what are the responses to the writings of books that you put out?
I can't keep the book stocked. I have sold over 7,100 of Sins of the South. It's not even a year old yet. My book signings are sellouts. My presentations are full house. In other words, not an empty chair. But, you know, that's all very, very flattering. It is. I'm not going to deny that. And I'm glad that the interest is there. The Countess and the Mob, same thing. Although, locally, I would have to say it was somewhat rejected because of the subject matter. I don't think the majority of the people realized that Mrs. Kennego had a double life. I don't know how else to put it. The newspaper would not acknowledge the book. I think the author has to be prepared for such things. I was, and that was okay. The bookstores carried it and can't keep it on the shelf. And it's now going on 3 years old. So the interest in the subject matters has been overwhelming in my eyes. I did not expect this kind of activity with it. And both books may very possibly become movies. So that was, again, something else I did not expect at all.
Well, the Sins of the South, I mean, you had a request for this investigating rights board from a deputy governor for the state of Illinois who is the son of the individual involved.
Yes.
I mean, that is beyond comprehension.
Yes. And he did not know that the book was done. Some friends, there was an event that was going to be held in Metropolis, Illinois, and there was going to be over 300 people there, and I thought, what a perfect place to present the son of Mr. Winchester a copy of the book, especially since it was dedicated to him. And that was done in Metropolis, and that was just a remarkable event to participate in. And Bob Winchester was totally taken off guard, totally surprised and overwhelmed.
Joanna, what has been the response to your book? How many books have you got? I mean, Joanna, you got the one here on this one. Do you got other ones that are in the works, or both? Do you have other books in the works?
I have another book in the works, but this is my first, my debut novel, so yes.
And what has been the response to that?
Well, I have to tell you, it has been a joy to my heart. I've always been the type of person who I love to connect with other people through the arts. But to be able to do so with your own work is something that it has expanded my heart into places of gratitude that I didn't even know existed. On a book tour shortly after the book was published, every place that I went, whether you're in a bookstore in New Orleans and it's packed with people, or you're in a bookstore in a remote part of West Virginia and there are, you know, two people who show up, just the connections that you make with other people, and when you read your work and when people respond to it and when they tell you things about your work that you may not even have known, but they have brought their own presence to the work and enriched it in such a wonderful way, it is, I cannot describe just the profound gratitude that I feel for being able to connect with other people through through the literary record, you know, and one that you have created, and then one that they have brought their own presence to and contributed to through being a part of your book, either as a reader or just someone who is interested in showing up and hearing what you have to say. And I would say I heard Maureen talk about presentations that she's given, and that's something I always tell other writers, someone who has a new book out. Don't just go somewhere and read your book. Go somewhere and present something about your book. I will often accompany readings with a presentation about the South Midland dialect and what it is and where it came from, or just a presentation about American dialects, especially if I'm outside of the southern part of the United States, because people are very interested in that, and they're interested in knowing about the things that you learned along the way as you were creating your book. And so I think that when you can offer something in addition to just, you know, a reading of your work, because certainly with a successful reading, if people enjoy it, they're going to pick up the book and they're going to take a copy home with them. But if you can also share with them some kind of experience outside the book, but that also has to do with the book, I think that's so much fun, and I really enjoy
those. We're running out of time here.
Well,
how do people get your books? I mean, Joanna, how can people get, where can they order, how can they obtain a copy of your book?
Well, probably the easiest way is Barnes & Noble or Amazon. So they can go straight to the publisher. The publisher is Southeast Missouri University Press, a wonderful small press that has just excellent books. So, but those are probably the easiest ways to get the book. They can also get it at the next Friday at the Rantoul Public Library.
Yeah. And Maureen, how can people obtain your copy? I know I've seen your copy of your book are available even at the local gun stores.
Yes. They can email me at Maureen, Maureen, _3849 at yahoo.com. Barnes & Noble, any bookstore can get it. Let's see, I mentioned Amazon, yeah. If they contact me directly, I will send them a signed copy.
Yeah, it's totally neat. That's always fun.
Yes.
It's pretty neat. One thing I know, Maureen, you and I could go on forever and ever and ever talk about research methodology. How do you gather information? What you do with the information once you gather it? How do you process it? I mean, it's just an incredible, incredible process.
It is.
For both of your books, it was extraordinarily extensive, wasn't it?
It was an enormous task, and I can honestly say I was drained after the research ended for Sins of the South.
In Sins of the South, in that book, you actually have photographs of the time period and everything. How do people go about getting photographs and then using those?
Usually, the state of Illinois, Springfield. I acquired a copy of Mr. Winchester when he was at Menard through the Menard Correctional System. And I got to say that this is a difficult process, and it's kind of like you have to give blood to get it, and you're not always successful. I could not acquire everything that I wanted, but just keep plugging away. And I imagine for Joanna it was a little bit different, but when it's a true crime subject, which my books are, it is time consuming. You have to write a lot of letters, fill out a lot of forms, but that's all part of it.
And what has happened now with Sins of the South? I mean, obviously, it's many, many years ago where it happened. Most of the people involved are all long gone. But how, when you're working on cold cases and solving the cold case, how does that interplay with the judicial system?
Often not well. I was another case that I am working on. Police departments, I think, have a fear of investigative reporters or journalists. My goal is not to take the case away from them, but to write about the case. If I can solve it, that's perfect. Again, today there are more criminal cases than there are law enforcement officers. And I know from experience their caseload is overwhelming. So I would never discredit the work they had done. And if allowable, I will mention them in my books. Sins of the South, they did not want to be mentioned. And when you read the book, there's obvious reasons.
Have you been able, both of you, been able to take the work you've done and translate that to further other things and do more things? I mean, Maureen, I mean, obviously you can do some teaching on teaching law enforcement how to do investigations, how to gather information.
Yes, my presentations are typically just that. I was at in Danville at the college there this past Thursday doing that very thing, showing students how I figured out that it wasn't a suicide at all. And then other things to look for.
Joanna, what can you, I mean, in closing, what can you suggest? I mean, yours is a feel-good, happy story, correct?
Well, not entirely.
Okay. more real life and everything?
Yes, absolutely real life.
So what do you hope people take away from your novels, your books?
Well, I hope that they have just a very wonderful, fulfilling reading experience, ultimately. And I think that one of the best questions that I'm asked when I go to a reading or I meet someone who's read the book, and let me tell you how wonderful it is to go to a reading and to meet people who've already read the book, and they showed up because they wanted to meet you and wanted to talk to you about the book, and that is just an absolute pleasure. But
That's right.
Isn't it fabulous? And just
it
that
is.
They took the time to come and meet you. And one of the things that many people have asked is, when is the sequel coming out? When is the next book coming out? And this is something that I've shared with other writer friends of mine, and some of them are like, oh, no, they think it's a series, you know, and sometimes with literary fiction that, you know, isn't necessarily a good thing. But I tell them, no, that's the highest compliment I can be paid.
That's
well,
right.
Ladies, thank you, Joanna, Maureen. Thank you for joining Warrior Connection. Incredible conversation. This worked out really good. Ladies and gentlemen, get the books, read anything that you're interested in. Find the book, and if you want to, start writing. There's a lot of people who can help. Rantoul Public Library has local author fairs. These individuals will be featured at it on coming up next Friday and Saturday on April 19th and 20th. Well, ladies and gentlemen, have a good day and God bless America. Joanna, Maureen, thank you very much for being on Warrior Connection.
Thank you, Doug.
It was a pleasure.